Yeah. My theme. So
hello.
Construction coming up here to talk about sustainable building materials and how you can change the world with architecture. So I just want to do a shout out to Elle Gaskin. Has been doing some great work around the station. She does the show, I guess now it's at 3 o'clock. She does it remotely at 3 o'clock, to the moon and back, about spirituality, and she does a lot of tarot or card reading stuff. And, you know, me, I'm not really into astrology, but I got to say, Virgo, I'm a Virgo, and every time I look at my, especially the Eugene Weekly, gets my horoscope right every time. I don't know how they do that, but Virgo, I'm organized to a certain level, you know. And I got to say, my birthday, I was always the youngest in the class, so there is some science to this. You know, being the youngest in the class, I was always the most immature class clown person in the class. And you know, you're mostly made out of water, so the moon must affect you at least a little bit in some way. How about that comet the other day? I looked up, I got to work the other day, I look up about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and there's this blob with stuff shooting out of it going into a slivered moon. That was fantastic. So, yeah, like I say, coming up here, try to give you solutions here on KEPW 97.3, Eugene Peaceworks Community Radio, simulcast on KEPW.org, KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Show's talk is cheap. I'm your host, DJ SSD. Coming up, Tobin Newberg on sustainable building materials. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. We'll be right back. just waiting for Tobin Newberg to call in, and just want to, you know, we got Dr. Zoom still coming on Sundays. I think he's doing his show remotely. You want to check that out. And what else? You know, I just saw the Resilience Festival, I believe, is going to happen this year at the River Road Center over there in August. So I'm hoping that's going to happen. And I'll be bringing you stuff from the Resilience Festival. What else? Looking at Lois Arkin does the LA Eco Village. You know, you can invest in, investment advice here, but you can invest in eco villages. Might be something to think about rather than investing in oil. So, the show's talk is cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, talking about sustainable building materials here. I try to bring you people that are doing something in the world, not just complaining. But there'll be a little bit of complaining here and there, too. What else? Firewalker Radio on Fridays. We'll always give you the 411 on things. And you always want to check them out. You don't want to start your weekend without listening to Firewalker Radio. Okay. Tobin, is that you?
It sure is.
Okay, so this is Tobin Newberg of Rainbow Valley Design and Construction. Have I got that right?
That's correct.
All right, so let's start out with you've done a lot around the community. I saw this house that you guys built for the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Can you tell me about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, we've done a couple of projects with Make-A-Wish. Now we've done two projects. One, there, you know, obviously the program is working with children who have had some sort of adverse setback due to health situation. And so we had two really fun projects we got to work on. One was a Bowser castle for a child in Springfield. And most recently, right at the beginning of the COVID situation, we completed a pirate ship play structure down in Cottage Grove. So both great projects, great people to work with, and we've had a lot of fun working with Make-A-Wish Foundation.
And what materials did you use to make those? Just out of curiosity.
You know, the Bowser Castle is sort of is primarily exterior grade plywood and paint and some recycled plastic components. The one in Cottage Grove, the pirate ship, was a lot of fun. It was a salvaged sailboat that we cut in half and sort of repurposed and reused and put a big poop deck on the back with a crow's nest and all of that, but it was a boat that was destined for the scrapyard from, you know, one of the spots here in town, and they gave us the boat for free, and we were able to repurpose it and reuse it for that and convert it into a pretty cool pirate ship.
Wow, fantastic. And then what is the Bold Choice Award? That's a Eugene Award?
Yeah, Bold Choice is, one of the recognitions for, making steps in sustainability and, trying to be a good, upstanding part of our community and do good work with, make sustainable choices.
All right, and so we've done stuff with Square One. We all know about Square One. That is a fantastic thing that they're doing.
Sure.
You know, real quick, I started doing 10x10 structures, and we'll talk about this a little bit more later because
cool.
The building codes. Well, because of the building codes, you can do something in 10x10 without getting a building permit. But tiny houses, even if they're only 120 square feet, they still need a building permit. Correct.
Yeah, so technically in the city of Eugene anyway, and it's really an adoption of the International Building Code, is that any structure that's habitable, regardless of its size, is supposed to have a building permit. people find gray areas within that, but if you ask the city, they will tell you that the official rule is that any habitable space requires a permit.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Do you know anything about how the tiny house got started? I don't, other than I know they used to be on wheels,
with
right?
Square One?
Well, no, in general, the tiny house movement.
I don't know the origin of it. Obviously, people have been living in tiny houses since the beginning of living in houses.
A cave, but, I guess, is a tiny house.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and you know, the RV builders have been building really highly efficient small spaces for a long time as well. And, you know, it kind of caught on as a trend of DIYers building their own trailer-based, small houses out of conventional building materials. So they looked a little more like houses and a little less like RVs, but by being on a trailer, they were able to find the loophole in the code, because the building code doesn't cover recreational vehicles and things on trailers. And so you don't have to deal with the same egress requirements and other things that have held tiny houses back for a while.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I used to see them on wheels when I first saw the tiny house.
Yeah.
Movement. Yeah, so what can you tell me about Square One?
Square One is great. We've seen a lot of praise for the work that they're doing and helping to find a cost-effective way of housing people who are unhoused and working with them to create the stability that they need to get back on their feet. And many of the people that either are part of their program to sort of rent to own, sort of a purchase agreement on the homes, end up transitioning out of that housing because just the stability of that type of housing allows them to do the things in life that they need to keep making more steps. In general, Square One has been promoting these tiny house villages in this area and nationwide. And we were a part of the EVE project here in Eugene, Emerald Village, Eugene. And what they did there was work with a number of architects and contractors here in town. And the idea was that if you could produce something for under, I think it was $15,000 of materials, we donated the labor and the material costs along with some of our building partners that we work with and designed a tiny home for that village. And then they became sort of a idea for modeling, a model that could be used for any villages like this throughout the area. So that design has the ability to be replicated in other places. And the woman that lives in our house is wonderful, and she's been able to help her family kind of move up and transition. And she's a community leader within that youth community. So it's been a really a rewarding for us project to be a part of.
Okay, so we're going to get a little controversial here, because now I have a lot of people that are involved in this station. There's a lot of forest defenders that are involved in this station. So,
sure.
So they would be against the sustainability ratings. And, you know, I'll tell you, I wasn't part of it, but in the 90s, we had to demonstrate to get Home Depot to sell certified lumber, that certified sustainable lumber. We had to demonstrate in front of Home Depot back in the 90s, sure, to get them to even sell it. So, I mean, it's
absolutely
definitely
which is great.
It's definitely a step in the right direction. Okay, so tell me about, so you use sustainable wood in all your projects.
We do our best. I'm not going to say that we are leading the way in the sustainable forestry movement. We do our best to use lumber that is from sustainably managed forests. However, there is a lot of truth to, we feel the impacts of the forestry here in Oregon deeply, obviously. Anybody that sort of peeked behind the green curtain along the highways has seen the impact of logging operations, of plantation, monocropping and the herbicides and things that are used within that. So even many forests that are called sustainable or renewable have their problems. However, people do continue to want to build houses and other buildings, and wood is one of the more renewable products for that. And study after study does show that while it has some problems of its own, it does tend to be a one of the least impactful on the earth from a carbon and energy sort of standpoint, as well as air quality and water quality impact. So that's one reason, probably the main reason that we continue to choose to build out of wood, but we can talk about more of those details as well. But, yeah, so wood has its challenges, but it is a product that's readily available to us here in Oregon. Typically, framing wood doesn't come out of old-growth forest. Old-growth wood is sort of prized for its clear vertical grain. So if it's going to be used, it's going to be used in finishes, like trim packages and things like that, rather than just in framing the building.
Well, and stressed skin, I got to admit, is mostly glue and sawdust, basically.
Sure.
Because I keep seeing buildings made entirely out of wood around town, and then they put that stressed skin around the framing. And it just irks me every time I see that. But so you're saying at least it's a step in the right direction. And
Oregon State actually was a leader in developing a formaldehyde-free glue that's being used more and more in those composite engineered products. And so engineered lumber is certainly making, doing a great job of creating an opportunity for harvesting forests in a much faster way, so you can use wood that's only 10 to 20 years old and essentially chip it up to create OSB products like you're talking about, and a variety of other products that are glued together. I think that they just finished a 10-story building in Portland that is all made out of wood, and again, all of these engineered products, they involve a lot of glue, but they're able to use much smaller trees rather than, you think of like timberline logs as beams that are a foot thick and 3 feet deep, the size of tree that something like that must have had to have come out of, whereas these engineered products do allow people to build with much more rapidly harvested timber resources.
Well, when you say rapid, then you mean that they're not using old growth timber, they're using young timber that they've done on a farm. But
exactly.
And then I will say, I know I worked for this grocery store in L.A. that it burned down 1 year, and I'll never forget the glue lamb in there survived.
Sure.
Whereas a steel building, if it catches on fire, all the steel warps in there. So believe it or not, wood actually performs better in a fire. All right,
so glue lamb is great that performs so well. It's going to perform like timber, but you're right. Large timbers are going to perform better than steel in a lot of cases. Steel in most occupancy types, meaning number of people using a building, is going to be required to have a fire retardant applied to it, because while people think of steel as being fireproof, it does tend to melt and warp and do other things that are not always optimal in a fire.
All right, and I'm sure, and I'm not saying you're doing this on purpose, but doesn't it take less skilled labor, though, to use wood rather than to use, I mean, if you use steel framing, it has to be, and everything has to line up perfectly for a steel-framed building, right? Whereas there's some margin of error for a wood-framed building. So it takes much more skilled labor to work with other building materials like brick and steel.
I suppose that might be true. I don't see it as much as a more or less skilled labor, because honestly, light steel framing is primarily used in the commercial sector. It's not used very much in the residential sector. And so, and not to say that commercial framers are less skilled than residential framers, but the tolerances are greater. And so I actually think that the time and attention put into most high-end residential construction is probably tighter tolerances than goes into a lot of those steel projects.
Right, okay, but you can't see the steel inside of a building.
Sure.
Why are we still using wood framing?
I do think that it is more finicky, so it takes more time, and it's less malleable in the sense of what you can do with it. So you do the national average that I've seen is that steel costs about 15% more to work with. And so, therefore, I think a big part of that is in the labor, not the skillfulness of the labor, just the more time it takes to sort of mess around with it. if you, you know, they're building techniques that allow us to sort of put buildings together quite a bit more quickly with wood, because how easy it is to cut, how easy it is to put fasteners into, the versatility of different types of fasteners you can use, and that's one of the things that allow wood to remain easier to work with and faster and therefore more cost-effective.
Okay, so you brought up funding. So what I'm going to talk about is, again, I'm not hostile or against you at all. I don't mean this. But the public funding, like in Detroit, I emailed you the example. In Detroit, they'd tear down these beautiful, I don't know whether you'd call them craftsman style, but they're these beautiful brick buildings that they're tearing down, and then they just put up cheap wood buildings in replacement. Uh-huh. And the city is funding this. Wouldn't it be better for the city to use that money to pay for the more expensive brick or steel building? And would you be willing to do that if you had the funding? If a client came to you and said, "Hey, I've got this low interest loan or this grant from the city, and I'm going to use steel framing, and yes, it's going to cost 15% more," wouldn't that work?
So a couple things in there. One, a brick building is rarely ever actually a brick building unless it's maybe 200 years old. But most brick buildings are just, the brick is a skin or a facade. It's the type of siding. So it's actually a much more expensive, higher embodied energy version of siding is all the brick is.
Mm-hmm.
So in some sense, it's nice because it's durable, but also brick has some moisture issues related to it. That's not great in every climate and has to be done a very specific way. So all of those buildings you're talking about are most likely actually wooden buildings that have brick, you know, on them.
And assuming they haven't gone into disrepair, though, wouldn't it be better to rebuild an existing building than to start from scratch?
Yes. Generally speaking, that's the case. And that we, Rainbow Valley, we're, we do maybe 3 new houses a year and 60 remodeling jobs again. So
fantastic.
When I'm asked to speak about sustainability, that really to me is always a key part of the conversation, is that finding ways to live in our buildings longer, and when we do make new buildings, make them adaptable and flexible and able to sort of change with the occupants and change with future occupants. And rather than thinking of buildings, a wood building, as being a 50-year building, we can think of them as 100-year buildings, 150-year buildings. And so I absolutely agree that where houses are being torn down to put in newer, cheaper housing, there are a lot of opportunities there for people to come in and preserve those houses and utilize the resources that are there. Sometimes they are too far gone and the embodied energy is actually lower, or really what it becomes is any, I think what they say is on a 60-year cycle, which might be sort of a low average of how long a house might last, 75% to 80% of the energy consumed in that house is operational energy, which means that only 20% to 25% of it is the embodied energy of the original built house. And so that's a huge, you know, we're saying 3 times the energy is in the using of that house. Well, old houses tend to be highly inefficient in their energy use. So there are times where you can only retrofit so far, and you're not going to be able to reduce that operational energy to balance out what would have been the embodied energy cost of a new home. So there are times where new homes do make sense, but generally I completely agree. And some of our most fun and rewarding projects we've worked on in town have been working with clients who want to take an old sort of rundown, semi-dilapidated, inefficient, not interesting home and go the full mile and do all of the energy upgrades, all of the durability upgrades, and make it a fun, exciting new home again, and kind of revive the housing stock in the neighborhood that way.
Well, now, you brought up, I didn't discuss this with you, but I took a class in energy audits, and it seems to me I'm not convinced that sealing off a building completely is the right way to go. I mean, you need fresh air in buildings, And to seal off a building and then rely on an air conditioner to put for all internal air, I'm not convinced about that. But you probably know more about this than I do. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Is that?
Yeah. Well, the energy code does, or not the energy, the building code does have a requirement for fresh air exchange. So I wouldn't think of it as coming through an air conditioner necessarily, but in a lot of cases, it does come through a mechanical ventilation system. So.
Well, because in the energy audits, you actually put a blower on the door and look, yep, to see how much leaks are coming out of your building. And the idea is to get rid of all of those leaks, isn't it?
As close as possible, yeah. So I forget what the building code maximum is right now, but what you're saying for the listeners is that you open up a front door usually and put what's called a blower door on it, which is a big sort of tarp thing that seals up the door but has a fan in it, and it's able to pump air either into the house or out of the house to pressurize it to specifically 50 pascals usually. And then at that point, as the fan works to maintain that pressure, it understands how much air it's pushing through it to be able to keep that pressure, and therefore you can measure what we call air changes per hour, how many times the air in a house cycles through under that 50 pascals of pressure. And the building code, I think, is around 4 or 5 air changes. I don't recall right now. But there are movements like the passive house movement that was originally out of Germany.
Right.
Is probably one of the highest standards for energy efficiency. And to meet the passive house standard, you need to be below 0.6 air changes per hour based on leakiness. But passive house also has a requirement for, I don't remember what it is, but something like 3 or 4 air changes per hour of, you know, like controlled ventilation. Controlled ventilation isn't always through a standard mechanical system. There are other sort of smaller, easier ventilation things that can open or close.
Well, and there's ways to do it with convection by orienting to the south and pulling air,
sure,
from the north side. Well, but see, my objection was that, for instance, in the energy audits, there was no provision for. I saw cases in the class where all you had to do is put an arbor on the south side and put more shade, you know, like they did in southern plantations. They have these,
sure,
big giant porches,
yeah, yeah,
where all you need was to put some shade around these houses, and they didn't really have a provision to do that. You know, you can't. There wasn't a grant to put an arbor. I mean, you probably could in some cases put an arbor around it, but I don't know. Well, so you're okay with? I mean, like in there's a whole move, you know, in hospitals you need, there's people that say that hospitals are bad because you don't get any fresh air in the fresh outside air in the hospital. So,
right.
I mean, what good is it to seal off a house when you need to open the windows anyway?
Because then you have control over that.
Uh-huh.
If in the wintertime you want to stay warm and you don't want to close your, you don't want to leave a window open, then you can rely on mechanical ventilation. But right now is a perfect example. Our days up until this week have been 75 degrees, perfect room temperature for the last month and a half. And it's a perfect time to just let all the windows be open and let the house breathe in the natural way that it wants to breathe and get all of that fresh air. You know, of course, unless you have an allergy issue, that may not work for you. But by controlling where the ventilation happens when we're either heating or cooling our home, we're able to use energy exchange. And so we can either, you know, we can use heat recovery ventilation or a variety of other options that allow us to control that. And some of these heat recovery ventilation options are 80 to 90% efficient. And so what they do is they'll pass the outgoing air from the house by a heat exchanger, which sort of looks like people look at the radiator on their car, a bunch of tubes go through something with a bunch of fins on it.
Mm-hmm.
So that allows incoming air to pass through this with the outgoing air. So if you're, say, on a heating day in our wintertime here in Eugene, the hot air that we've spent energy on to make warm and make comfortable for us, rather than dumping all of that energy out by having a leaky house and letting it just leak through all the cracks in our house, we're able to pass it through an air-to-air heat exchanger and if we can actually recover 80 to 90% of that heat energy and pass it on to the incoming ventilation air that might be 30 degrees or 40 degrees outside, and recover a lot of that energy. And that gets at that operational energy thing that I was talking about earlier.
Yeah, what is your experience with air conditioning mechanics, though? Because what happened with me, now this was back in 2012, is I called up an air conditioning guy after I got this energy audit thing. And he's like, he goes, we don't want to have nothing to do with this, because what you're doing is we've sold them a big air conditioner. And you're going in and saying that the air conditioner that we sold them was too big. And you're cutting into this, and you're gonna, and you want us to install, that we've installed the wrong equipment, and so he didn't want this.
Sure.
But that was back in 2012. Now maybe the things have changed, because let's face it, they're going to make more money installing a new air conditioner. But originally they were against it. They're just going, we just put an air conditioner in. You want to go in and seal up the house and put in a smaller, more efficient air conditioner.
Right. Sure. We don't do a lot of that, like, auditing in that direct sense. We do sort of offer a lower key version of an audit, and sometimes it does bring up issues with the design of the heating and ventilation and air conditioning of a home. But as far as our new projects go, I think ductless heat pumps have really become popular in the whole world. That they're catching on in Eugene, and heat pump technology in general is so energy efficient relative to your conventional heating and air conditioning system that I think that has been a big push in a lot of the projects we worked with. It retrofits really easily, so much of Eugene's housing stock has radiant ceilings or other versions of inefficient electric resistance heating. And so, I think ductless heat pumps have become a huge push for people that want to have more comfortable homes and use less energy to do that. Because a heat pump is able to, it's just pulling the heat out of the air, and rather than generating the heat itself, it's using the electricity to power fans, pumps, and compressors, and it's not actually using electricity to create BTUs of heat. And so by doing that, it's able to, it's about three times more efficient than electric resistance heat. It's about able to use a third of the energy to produce the same amount of heat. So we think that that is a great way to resolve some of those issues. But you're right. If you do an audit of a home and it comes back that the HVAC system is oversized and inefficient, that's not always the push of some of the HVAC contractors in this area, because they're not under the same scrutiny that they might be if they're same with insulation. If you're up in the Northeast where it's very cold in the winter, or down in the South or Southwest where it's very hot and there's a lot of air conditioning going on, insulation details, air sealing, and appropriate sizing of the mechanical systems are much more important. We have a very temperate climate here, which has allowed people to become kind of lackadaisical about their energy sort of consumption, I would say.
All right, so let's get into alternative building materials. We talked about, you and I talked about cob and straw bale and a little bit of, let's just start with a little bit with hemp, though. I know you don't know that much, but what is holding up hemp? I'm having trouble. I'm calling hemp people, and they don't seem to want to get on the ball. I mean, Bill Condi, years ago, had building materials made out of hemp. And what is stopping people from jumping on the ball? This guy, Hemp Press, over here, I talked to him. He said he had 50,000 pounds of slash from people growing hemp that he needs to get rid of. I noticed somebody was using hemp mulch. You can get hemp mulch, but I want to use hemp insulation in a small ADU that I have, and there's no place for me to get it, is there?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, there is a company in Canada, ironically out of Asbestos, Quebec, of all places, that is making hemp insulation, and it is available in the U.S. I'm not sure how available it is.
Well, but I'd have to buy a truckload of it, right? I can't just get a few, for an ADU, I can't just get a few panels.
I would imagine that is probably the case. Or if you did, you'd pay a lot for it.
Right.
So you'd be paying a lot of shipping costs for just a small amount. So I agree, that's a challenge. And hemp is certainly posing a high opportunity product. We are aware of how fast it can grow a fiber that, you know, people are talking about hempcrete as a possibility. And then as we were talking earlier about engineered timber products, it would seem that hemp could be a viable option as a fiber within some of these glue-based engineered products as well. So hemp seems like it has a lot of possibilities. That's not a movement that I'm personally involved with, so I don't know what is holding that up. My understanding is that there just aren't the processing facilities in the United States, and I'm not sure whether those are legal issues or economic issues or what the reasons are that it's not being processed.
Well, because I emailed Weyerhaeuser and I said, you know, if I could get a government subsidy for you to switch to hemp, would you do it? And they said, we don't want anything to do with that and we don't want your help. Basically, their email literally said, we don't want to do that and we don't need your help. Basically, that's almost verbatim that Weyerhaeuser was not interested in switching to hemp. At all. I don't see
I forget the exact Buckminster Fuller quote, but there's a quote, something along the lines of, when you want to change the system, you create a new alternative that makes the old system obsolete. So, you know, I think if you want to change Weyerhaeuser, you make them obsolete by creating the new product and the new companies that are creating, you know, the new change.
Well, that's just, and then I've called the Hemp Growers Association, and one of the DJs here is also involved in a hemp association, and they just are not seeing it, or I don't know what the problem is. I guess it's an economy of scale. They can't keep the cost down because of economy of scale, but I just can't understand why they're not even researching it, because, like I say, Hemp Press, he has a particle board that he wants to produce.
That'd be great.
Yeah, get a grant from, who would you get the grant from? Any ideas?
That's a good question. If I were in that industry, though, like I said earlier, Oregon State has their forestry department and as well as an engineering department. So I would say, and they've been developing forest products like the formaldehyde-free glues for plywood and that type of thing. So I would start poking around Oregon State and seeing who's there. You know, U of O also has some great resources, and I think that those are people that are deeply connected into the grant writing world and understanding how funding for innovative technologies works.
Well, because, yeah, I'm told Condi did go to Oregon State, but maybe now things have changed, and maybe Oregon State would be interested in that. I'm going to check that out. All right, and so so Cobb, I know that engineers are scared to death. Cobb would be considered unreinforced masonry. And in the third world, this is where you see movie or video or news reports all the time. Every time there's an earthquake in the third world, it's unreinforced masonry that has collapsed on someone and killed someone. So engineers are scared to death of unreinforced masonry. What's up with Cobb? There are a lot of Cobb buildings, and what's holding up Cobb? No pun intended.
I think, like you said, engineering becomes the foundation. There's room in the building code to a certain degree for things to happen that are alternatives, but you need engineers that are willing to stand behind them. And engineers, of course, are on the line for creating safe spaces, and their liability and being a part of a system that doesn't make dangerous buildings for people. And so they, by and large, are fairly conservative people, as I think they probably should be. But what they do, and we were talking about this earlier, is if I ask my engineer to design a big steel structure for me, they just pull out their steel manual, and they can understand the modulus of elasticity and the shear value and all of these other properties in steel. Whereas Cobb or a number of other alternative technologies, that information just isn't available yet. And I think that the biggest thing holding that back is some ability to create standardized testing and standardized formulas that both engineers can use and then the people building with them in the field can use to then create, replicate a standardized type of cob or that type of a thing. You've seen that with straw bale. There's some really interesting projects with straw bale. As people, originally straw bale was getting permitted as really just an infill where people would build timber frame buildings. So all of the structural work was being done by the timber. And then they would use straw bale as an infill, sort of insulation wall piece. There's a company, an engineering office out of Berkeley that has created a system where they make fully structural walls out of straw bale. But then what they do is, just the same way you would with any stucco, they apply sort of a metal grid screen to the outside of it, and then they have sort of a engineered system on how they blast concrete as the final stucco product onto it. I think they're building 2- or 3-story buildings out of structural straw bale by doing that. So there are engineers finding solutions for these things. I haven't been as deeply involved with the cob movement in about 15 years, so I'm not exactly sure what's going on in that world now. Then there were a lot of people working on slump tests and a variety of other ways to standardize the cob that people are using in the field, but I'm not sure where that is right now.
Well, but the point is, where does the funding come from? All these tests are very expensive. Like I was telling you, exactly, that this Nader Khalili, the EcoDome, EcoDome in Hesperia, California, where that's is literally on the San Andreas Fault. They wanted to put an entire building on what's called a shake table and build a building on a table and shake it to see if it falls down and measure at what stresses it falls down. That's very expensive. So who historically pays for those types of tests?
Well, yeah, I think that's a good question. And, I think there's a lot of opportunity for new funding sources, and I'm not sure who that should be exactly. But historically, it tends to be the companies that have a financial interest in that. And so if you have a product and you want to show that it is safe, you're going to make money off that product, and so you have the ability to get it tested and then become standardized. And I mean that happens everywhere from seeing products like Tyvek house wrap written into the building code as an example of a type of house wrap that would work, but all the way down to there's a local Oregon manufacturer of sky lift things that allow people to build patio covers on top of their walls, and they, they go produce the engineering data for it. Or a better example would be Fastwall out of the Philomath area up by Corvallis. They're making a construction block out of sawdust and a small amount of concrete, and it's now you build a house like Legos. But what they've done is they've paid internally to have all of the engineering done and all of the testing done so that they have the data to be able to give to engineers when we've built several of these Fastwall houses, and when we hire an engineer, they're able to contact Fastwall, get all of the data for it, and then they can do all their calculations and submit their engineering packet when we go to get permits.
Okay, but so Tyvek and Fastwalk are all huge corporations. These are all huge corporations that see an opportunity.
Fastwall is small.
But they see a monetary opportunity and then go pay for the testing because they know that there's already a market for it. But they have the money to do it. A small guy like Bill Condi, for instance, is not going to be able to do that. Wouldn't it be better?
I don't know that Fastwall is any bigger than what he... I don't know anything about his resources. But I don't know that Fastwall necessarily has any greater resources, but I think they did have the know-how on who to team up with and how to make that happen. There's a lot of barriers to that, helping people understand how to do that. But I agree. I think that...
But it's mostly monetary barriers that are holding it up.
That's part of it. I don't think it's mostly, but it's part of it. But I do think that we would all benefit from some other way of funding these tests that isn't relying on products that go to market. So back to the Cobb example, if the idea is that Cobb is really, it's expensive to pay somebody to build a Cobb house, but if it's very cheap to build your own house out of Cobb because you're using mostly resources that you can dig up on your own site. And so there's not any going to be anybody that goes and makes millions of dollars selling Cobb, but if it was something that was available for your average person to just go build their own Cobb house, that would be wonderful. That would be a great thing, I think, for creating affordable housing for certain people and reducing ecological impact and that type of thing. So having a way to fund the testing for alternative strategies like that would be wonderful. And I don't know if it's through private donors or public money or where the best source of that funding would be, but that would be great.
Well, but now, for instance, we talked about the to do a gray water system or a rainwater capture system.
Sure.
Now, the Plumbing Association, and I know I did fire alarms, and I know the Electrical Contractors Association sits on the board that makes these standards. They have a public official, an insurance person, and an industry person, and it's usually big electrical and big plumbing that are sitting on these boards. And so this is why, in my opinion anyway, that it's so expensive to do a gray water system, and you need a Rube Goldberg contraption to do a gray water system and even rainwater capture too. You need all this plumbing to sell more plumbing. So
it may be.
And safety though? The building code should be health and safety and not.
Yeah, I think we would benefit from building codes that are more performance oriented. But the problem with that is then people start complaining about having to pay for engineers to do everything. So right now, a lot of our building code is prescriptive. So if you don't want to pay for an engineer to tell you that the structure of your house is going to stand up, you can do that, and you can use an alternative method and use an engineer to do that. But if you want to build it out of the conventional building materials that are offered in the code, there's sort of a step-by-step process that anybody could go and read that code and design a house to meet that code and never have to hire an engineer to do it. So I think the only problem with a strictly performance-oriented code is that you need to prove that whatever system you're coming up with is going to do that. And typically we do that by paying engineers to make calculations to prove that it can meet the goals of filtering the water appropriately before dumping it back into the watershed, or filtering the water appropriately before we try to drink it, or a variety of other whatever we're doing with water in those instances.
Yeah, but what about public funding to do that? I mean, I'm not a socialist. I don't really believe in socialism, but this is where we need a Green New Deal to come in and pay for some of this new research and stuff. Because, for instance, I remember you're maybe not old enough to remember this, but when solar panels first came out, they had this thing called the golden switch. And you had to pay literally, I don't know how many thousands of dollars, and literally all it was a switch. Because the electrical company was afraid that you were going to overload their system with your little tiny solar panels.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted an interface between, and what the real what really it was they want to sell electricity. They did not want you producing your own electricity, and they were against Carter's mandate that they had to buy electricity from people. So they created this thing called the golden switch that you had to pay a huge amount of money to connect to their system. And that was what was costing so much for solar panels. And even to this day, I'm told that solar panels could be done much cheaper if it wasn't for all the regulations that are mainly for the contractors, for not the contractors, but the manufacturers.
Manufacturers, sure.
And
I don't know what all the regulations are for manufacturers, but I for one am an advocate of environmental regulations. I would like to know that they're not dumping pollutants into the water and into the ground and into the air.
Right, but
so I think there are some regulations that sure do make things more expensive, But
that's the point that I'm making.
Benefit.
The point that I'm making. I'm liberal. I'm as liberal as they come. Okay. I'm in favor of environmental regulations. What the problem is the regulations that we're dealing with are set by the manufacturers. They're not set by some liberal saying you stop polluting, dumping stuff in my water and air. The reason things are so expensive is because manufacturers have created a to make you buy more of their manufactured goods. That's where a lot of these regulations are coming from. But I'm not an expert on that.
I can't speak specifically to solar panels or any of these other products to say whether, you know, I know about that or not. But yes,
I've seen it in the fire alarm systems. They could easily go 50 feet. But of course, you don't want your house to burn down. I don't want. But now, you know, now they're making people put sprinklers in houses, and sprinklers are suppressive. They're fire suppressant. They are not. They are for asset protection. They're not for. You're not going to stand in your house underneath the sprinklers. When your house is on fire, you need to get out of your house. And sprinklers are there for asset protection. They're not a warning system at all for you to get out of the house. And the smoke.
You know, I think the biggest concern with sprinklers are catastrophic fires. So, you know, in Eugene, we see it more in the South Hills where we have a hillside full of dry forest. California has a lot of regulations regarding sprinklers because they've seen such huge catastrophic wildfires take down neighborhood after neighborhood. And so I think a big part of the push for sprinklers is probably more related to protecting beyond that one house but I agree it's asset protection.
Well, and you know, instead of funding fire departments and getting airplanes in and more airplanes, we pay for more sprinkler and pipe. I'm just not sure about that, but I am not an expert on that, and but I'm not against environmental regulations at all. We can't.
Yeah, it's tricky.
You can't put a valve on an oil well that you can shut the valve off. I mean, for God's sakes, you know. Do I really need to have a regulation? I mean, you know, we need the regulation, obviously, to tell you that you need to put a valve on your underwater oil well.
Right. Yeah. I agree that people making the most money off of some of these technologies are intentionally making it difficult for other technologies to rise up. But I also think that there are a lot of opportunities for new technologies and new building materials to come up. And what we can do is support programs that do fund the testing and understanding the material properties and technologies that allow us to do these things. And that's really what my focus as sort of an environmental activist and interest is to push that side of things, is to push the new alternative and creating opportunities for the new alternative. And sometimes that does mean removing roadblocks. And so as you're bringing up there, that's absolutely part of it. But I think your comment about, like, how do we fund the testing, I think that's a great question, and I hope that we find opportunities and people can, you know, if they care about these things, can talk to their representatives about that and raise public awareness about it and allow us to have, you know, ability for people to build their own homes cost effectively and safely and use technologies that have a lighter footprint on the earth.
All right, Tobin Newberg of Rainbow Valley Design and Construction. One more thing. How's business in the COVID-19 atmosphere? Are people still remodeling?
People are definitely still remodeling. I think that people have been sitting around their homes for a couple of months and are looking around at, you know, all the projects that they have in mind, and they want to get a lot done. I think people are also seeing the impact that things are having on the economy and a lot of our clients. You tend to be a little closer to retirement age, and so thinking about their investments and how that's going to impact their future planning. But generally, like I said, I think people are kind of just home and nesting and thinking more about family and how they're living, and projects are still happening. Of course, we had to go through a huge transition to really make sure that we were practicing safe practices in terms of social distancing and mask wearing and sanitizing and how we treated shared air and all of those parts of it. So we did take, we shut down completely for about a week while we retooled and rethought about that, and then took the rest of the month of March to sort of phase construction back in. But by April, we were at pretty full capacity again and practicing safely with a number of changes.
All right, I got to wrap it up. Tobin Newberg of Rainbow Valley Construction, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Have
all right.
a great day.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
We'll be right back. my sustainable brother from Kill Radio.
So this is David Rico,
the other station.
Who David helped start killradio.org, which was an online...
No.